It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up in our second half hour, as a boy, he lived in a refugee camp in his native Afghanistan. As a teenager, he fled from the Taliban to England. Now he is Afghanistan's ambassador to the United States. My conversation with Ambassador Hamdullah Mohib coming up in our second half hour. But first, with the election just 11 days away, this half hour we wanted to examine how your taxes might be changing depending on who moves into the White House. Joining us to do that, two financial experts. Art Dornev is Associate Professor of Finance at the Henry B. Tippey College of Business at the University of Iowa in Iowa City. Stephen Guerra is Associate Professor and Director of Accounting at Drake University in Des Moines. Stephen, Art, welcome to our program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We want to reach out to our listeners during this half hour. If you have questions about the candidates' tax plans, now is the time to call 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. You can email that question to river2river@iowapublicradio.org, or put it on our Facebook page or tweet us at IPR Talk. Let me start with you, Stephen. Broadly speaking, how do the tax plans put forward by Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton differ?
Well, they differ pretty much in terms of the direction they're headed. Secretary Clinton's proposals call for a significant increase in tax revenue from higher income individuals through an additional surcharge on income over $5 million, implementation of the so-called Buffett rule for individuals making over $1 million, and also scaling back the benefit from itemized deductions. Whereas, on the other hand, Mr. Trump's proposals actually call for a across-the-board tax decrease, though that decrease is going to be targeted primarily at high-income individuals.
Mm-hmm. When you say high-income individuals, are they in accordance? Are they on the same page when we define who is a high-income individual?
There is some consistency there. Generally speaking, it's those around $200,000 to $250,000 a year.
Mm-hmm. And above.
And above, correct.
Okay. Art Dornev, what is the thinking behind the tax policy positions? Broadly speaking, the two candidates have been giving their rationale for why they would make these changes. Well, how would you characterize those?
Yes, Hillary Clinton's main proposal is to increase taxes and spend the money on reducing the government budget, more on social work and social infrastructure, for example, to fix roads and fix bridges, and presumably that would lift the economy and increase the growth rate. On the other hand, we know that lower taxes are usually associated with the growth rate of the economy. So while under the Trump's proposal, the amount of money in the government coffers would be reduced, presumably the size of the economy will become bigger and the economy will be larger. So you have a bigger pie to split from.
Mm-hmm. Are you referring to what is commonly referred to as trickle-down economics? That term, I know, is disparaging to it, but Hillary Clinton charged Trump with supporting what she called, she upped it a little bit, she said trumped up trickle-down economics, a reference to the Reagan era. So this is the idea, correct me if I'm wrong, that if you give tax cuts to the wealthy, they will make more investment. There will be more jobs and more wealth that will trickle down to the working class?
Yes, this is the general idea. But one of the biggest disparities in the two proposals is how we would tax businesses. So Hillary Clinton proposes to increase business tax, not to directly increase business tax, but to make it to provide fewer incentives for American companies to relocate overseas where they pay lower taxes. Because companies like Google and Apple, while presumably they should be paying 35% on their corporate income, in reality they pay 25-22%. And there are lots of complicated loopholes there how they do that. And the Trump's proposal is just to say, look, you don't pay 35% anyways. If you pay 20%, why don't we make corporate tax rate 20%? And I'm a little bit more concerned about higher corporate taxes, because what it means that the stock prices, the product prices would increase, and also the shareholder returns would suffer. So I'm a little bit more against higher corporate taxes.
Stephen Guerra, what are your thoughts on business and corporate taxes under these two plans?
Well, essentially, Secretary Clinton's proposal would keep the rates as they are, 35%, which, as Mr. Trump indicates, is the highest corporate statutory rate in the industrialized world, which supposedly gives U.S. firms a disadvantage competing globally. Mr. Trump, however, would actually reduce the rate from 35 down to 15% for corporations as well as even for other forms of business such as partnerships and S corporations as well. So business tax overall will go down to 15%.
Mm-hmm. When you look at the two plans, Stephen Guerra, is there one that adds up better than the other in terms of, well, the government is taking in revenue and also spending revenue? Is one on the balance sheet making more sense when you crunch the numbers from an accounting point of view?
Well, the proposals primarily focus just on the tax side. Obviously, Secretary Clinton's proposal does have a bit more specificity in terms of where the money will be used. Her economic plan does include substantial increase in spending, particularly in areas of healthcare, education, and infrastructure, which the additional revenue that she's bringing in would help to fund that. Whereas Mr. Trump's proposal calls for lowering across taxes across the board and then unspecified spending cuts to offset that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Talk a little bit about the deficit. Not so much in this election cycle, but certainly in previous ones, been more prominent concern about our budget deficit. How, Art Dornev, would each of the candidates tackle that? Would one be more effective in bringing down our deficit? And is that necessarily our top priority?
Well, the deficit right now looks more or less healthy. It's around $500 billion. A few years ago, it was twice as large. Just to give you a comparison, the deficit.
So it's improved under the Obama administration.
Oh, absolutely, it improved. But it looks healthy. Whether it goes up by 10% or down, it doesn't make so much difference. I think the discussion should be focused more on how to make the economy grow, because right now the United States economy, just like the rest of the world, is going through what's called the phase of sclerotic growth. It grows, but only by 1-2% a year. So if the economy grows 10% a year, like in China, it takes 7 years to double the size of the pie, the economy. Then it would have more money to spend. With 1% growth rate, it takes 70 years. So I think the discussion should be how to make the pie bigger rather than how to split the pie.
Mm-hmm. If we zoom into a family level, Stephen Guerra, let me ask you this. Someone wondering out there, I don't know, an average middle income out there, what do you see as the things they should be paying attention to in these two candidates' tax policies?
For those that are actually middle income, Secretary Clinton's proposal would result in a very modest, if any, change. Most of her focus is on increasing revenue from high income. For those that are middle and low income, there's really no difference. However, the Trump proposal does include a modest decrease. He actually is going to replace the individual tax rates across the board, high, low, and middle income. And so those in middle moderate income will probably see some decrease under Trump and probably zero, if any, under Clinton.
Mm-hmm. If you just joined us, we're talking about how your taxes might change depending on who moves into the White House with Stephen Guerra of Drake University and Art Dornev of the University of Iowa's College of Business, two financial experts to help us pick that apart. If you have a specific question about taxes under the future president, join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. When we talk about tax reform, and that's been talked about many years, Art Dornev, what do you think about our taxes needs to be reformed most urgently?
I think the entire system is in urgent need for reform. In the United States, they have the most complicated, the most cumbersome, and rather obsolete system of taxation. Just imagine the amount of paperwork you fill out, and even much more paperwork for the corporation. So it's not about whether we should increase taxes or decrease taxes. We just need to fix the entire tax system. The same as the discussion about whether we need bigger government, smaller government, or we need more social programs or fewer social programs. I think both the government and the social programs need to be fixed. Just to give you an example, the current tax tax system is extremely cumbersome and gives the wrong incentives. If you move your income by $1, you lose in benefits more than $1. So then, for people, there is no incentive to increase their income. They'd rather increase their benefits. So the entire system needs to become more transparent And less obsolete, and that's where the reform should be focused on, I think.
What are your ideas on reform, Stephen Guerra?
Actually, I agree with that. The one attractive feature of the Trump proposal is there is a lot of simplification in there. For example, he significantly increases the standard deduction amount to $15,000 for single and $30,000 for marriage filers. As well as cutting back on the number of filing statuses. So there's a effort at simplification here that would make people's tax returns quite a bit easier and less costly to fill out, which might be bad news for H&R Block. But
and CPAs, the business in general. But when we talk about simplification, we're talking about getting rid of a lot of deductions. And deductions are there, Stephen, for a reason, right, to incentivize certain behavior. And do what else? So we would have a, I guess I'm really asking, what are the pros and cons, the trade-offs in scaling back deductions and simplifying our taxes?
Well, part of the issue is the complication. Even though there's a lot of deductions available, most of those like charity, medical, unreimbursed job expenses are all itemized, and the vast majority of taxpayers do not do that. They take standard deduction, even because it may not be the better option, but it's simply the simpler one. And so there's a lot of time and effort involved. The other issue, of course, is the benefit you get from a deduction, because that results in less revenue for the government. Is the social benefit from that worth the loss of revenue?
Mm-hmm. You mentioned H&R Block, one of the tax-preparing services in our country, certainly many other ones, Stephen. And you are an associate professor of accounting at Drake University. So I wonder if those tax preparation businesses are influencing this at all.
I doubt so. Generally speaking, obviously, simplification is a desirable goal, but obviously, like you said before, if it means giving up certain deductions or benefits, you have to ask yourself, is it worth it?
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about some of the tax items that's been in the news during the campaign. Most significantly, the candidates releasing or not releasing their tax returns. Hillary Clinton has made her income taxes, her returns public going back many years, those returns together with her husband, Bill Clinton. That's in keeping with the major party presidential candidates going back some 40 years. Donald Trump has not. He says he will when the IRS is through with an audit, though the IRS says there's nothing preventing him from releasing his tax returns. Now, a few weeks ago then, the New York Times reporting that it had obtained Donald Trump's 1995 tax records, at least three pages of those. It quoted experts as saying that the $916 million loss he reported for that year may have allowed him to avoid paying federal income taxes for up to 18 years. Trump says he worked within the tax law, and that makes him smart. The point here, Stephen, if I can ask you first of all, how should everyday Americans view our tax system when a billionaire, can be Donald Trump, can be anybody, can pay no taxes for 18 years or whatever length of time, the rest of us, earning far, far less, do pay our taxes? Isn't that an indictment of our tax system in itself?
It does definitely indicate that the system does have a flaw. I mean, obviously, the loss that was incurred that year presumably was a legitimate loss and came from his business activity that year. And there's a reason for being able to use that loss to offset his future profit. Essentially, there's an equity argument to be made there. But obviously, if you're, if you're a mid or lower income individual, you see this going on, it does erode your trust in the system.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, the tax compliance system we have today is very much influenced by people having faith and trust in the system.
Mm-hmm. Art Dornev, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I completely agree. It just, again, the system is so complicated that personally I don't see any wrongdoings by candidate Trump. But again, there is just, unless you're like a tax accountant, tax expert, it's really like almost impossible to decipher the whole system. So that definitely erodes the trust in the system. This is why actually for both candidates do propose a more transparent system, like Senator Clinton, she says that if you make them more than $4 million, there's going to be like a flat 4% surcharge tax. So there are good items in the proposal that would make the system more transparent.
Join our conversation at 1-866-780-9100. You can email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org, or tweet us at IPR Talk. Tyler in Des Moines tweets this question for the two of you. Wouldn't increasing taxes on businesses encourage them to spend money rather than hoard cash reserves? For example, hire. Stephen, what do you think of that reasoning?
To the extent that if they incur an expense and the expense is deductible, it results in lower income to be taxed. That's true. But on the flip side, if a business views paying taxes as just another expense, then if that expense goes up, they'd want to cut another expense to maintain the profitability. Mm-hmm. So they might cut back on hiring.
James emails us with this question. Has either of the candidates mentioned a carbon tax? I heard one is on the ballot in Washington, writes James in his email. Now, the carbon tax is a tax on business or whatever using fossil fuels, depending on how much you put out into the atmosphere, right, Art?
Yes,
I don't know if this is your area of expertise.
Yes. Green technology, it is one of my areas of expertise. So I've heard of that proposal. But again, the technology keeps changing very fast, and definitely the current technology, the current plants and cars, they pollute much less. So as the technology evolves, it's not clear what exactly is going to happen to that specific carbon tax. Mm-hmm. So next year they'll have to come up with another tax probably.
Stephen Guerra, anything to add to the question about carbon tax?
Just that the two candidates do not incorporate that in their proposal. However, Secretary Clinton does include in her tax proposal a number of incentives for clean energy investment. So instead of actually having a tax on carbon generation, she kind of targets it as an incentive to reduce carbon production.
Mm-hmm. A lot of talk over the past years about the estate tax. Those of certain political persuasion like to call it a death tax. This is taxing estates, I think currently, correct me if I'm wrong, Stephen, worth $3.5 million or more. If you'd like to pass that on to family members, and Hillary Clinton would like to lower that below $3.5 million, or what is your understanding, Stephen?
The current exemption amount is actually about close to $5.5 million.
Okay.
So almost $11 million for a married couple. She would like to reduce it down to $3.5 million.
Okay, that's where the figure $3.5 million comes in.
As well as increase the top rate from 40% to 55%.
Mm-hmm. And when we talk about someone having that kind of wealth, $5 million. That's what small percentage of the American population?
Yeah. Less than 1%.
Less than 1%. I want to ask either of you, Art, what is being left out of this conversation as we talk about taxes and how they might change moving, depending on who moves into the White House?
I think what's left out is what effect this newly proposed tax system would have on economic growth in general. Because the idea is to fund more programs to reduce the budget deficit. But again, the better way to reduce the budget deficit is probably maybe to reduce taxes and then to increase the growth rate of the economy and make the entire economy size, entire pie, larger. Because what's happening right now, there's lots of talk about short-term solutions. So the economic growth is sluggish. So every candidate proposes, it's like when a person starts getting overweight, then you get hit by all those ads, 10 days, new diet, I'm going to lose weight. But, you know, the only solution is the old-fashioned solution, exercise and diet and a lot of hard work. That mm-hmm. would pull them up rather than quick fixes.
When you reduce taxes, Art, going back to your comment just a moment ago, when you reduce taxes, does that necessarily mean economic growth, or?
Well, there is strong empirical evidence that lower taxes are associated, especially business taxes and taxes on investment, are associated with higher economic growth. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to a quick question before we end this conversation. Or did you want to jump in there, Stephen?
Not really. It's the only.
Okay.
Just the underlying issue here is also going to be, even if you're successful in getting elected, the next challenge is getting Congress to go along with you.
Oh, right. And significant hurdles there. I don't know how much you want to add to the politics of that, but we have a Congress that is in a logjam in a lot of ways, don't we?
Correct.
Okay. Let's go to Roger in Cedar Rapids. Roger, sorry, not much time before we end this segment, but you have a question concerning taxes.
Okay. Yes. I was wanting to know, I received disability, a Social Security disability, and I was wanting to know if there were taxes on that, and if so, how much?
Okay. Well, let's ask Stephen Guerra about that, and perhaps you could include, Stephen, if anything changes there in the area of disability. That's quite a fine point there to
right.
ask you about, but what do you have to say?
Well, neither proposal mentions anything about the taxation of Social Security benefits. Currently, they are potentially taxed depending upon your level of income. So if your income level is relatively modest, usually the benefits are not taxed.
Stephen, before we go, I didn't ask you, what do you think perhaps is being left out of this discussion that you'd like to include?
Well, the big sort of black hole for me has to do with Mr. Trump's proposal in terms of how he's going to actually pay for the lost revenue. He talks about spending cuts, but never actually has a lot of detail regarding what those would be. So that's one question I would have is basically, where's the money coming from?
So there's more specifics in Hillary Clinton's plan about where the money's coming from.
Well, since her proposal is primarily increasing revenue, the issue there really is where the money will be going. And her plan does include, again, health, education, infrastructure. The difference is that against Mr. Trump's proposal is more tax cuts. So the question is, where's the lost revenue going to be coming from to avoid having an increase in the deficit?
Stephen Guerra touched on this a moment ago, Art Dornev, but your comment on how much influence a president really does have in this political climate, how much influence does the next president really have in changing the tax code or changing how much we pay the government?
Well, yeah, sometimes I think it's actually it's a big advantage that many promises the presidential candidates make. Sometimes they don't get implemented because any tax reform would have to go through a lot of discussion at the Senate and Congress. So no matter who becomes the president, we're not going to see an immediate change.
Right. And if their proposals don't make it, they can always say, well, there's the Congress to blame.
And maybe this is a good thing.
Stephen Guerra, thank you very much. Associate Professor and Director of Accounting at Drake University in Des Moines, Art Dornev, Associate Professor of Finance at the Henry B. Tippey College of Business at the University of Iowa. Stephen, Art, thank you so much for joining us this half hour.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up in just a moment, I'll have a conversation with Afghanistan's ambassador to the United States who is in Iowa this week. He grew up partly in a refugee camp in his native Afghanistan, and then he fled the Taliban. That conversation coming up in just a moment. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's America's longest war. American troops have now been in Afghanistan for nearly 15 years. Over 2,300 Americans have died in the conflict. 8 years ago, then-candidate Barack Obama advocated focusing more on the war in Afghanistan with an eye toward enabling a stable Afghan government to take complete control of the country so U.S. troops could leave. However, earlier this year, the president announced the U.S. will maintain approximately 8,400 troops in Afghanistan into next year. So the task of figuring out what to do about Afghanistan will be left to the next president. Joining us this half hour to discuss security efforts in Afghanistan, combating the Taliban, and the U.S.'s role in Afghanistan is the current ambassador to the U.S. from Afghanistan, Ambassador Hamdullah Mohib. Welcome to our program.
Oh, thank you for having me, Ben.
The ambassador is in Des Moines this week as a guest of the Greater Des Moines Committee on Foreign Relations. Let's start off right now with recently reports that we've heard the Taliban has held informal meetings with Afghan and U.S. officials, the first direct meetings in more than a year after a process to halt the long conflict collapsed. How close is the restart of formal talks?
Well, Ben, the desire of the Afghan people has always been a peace process, and that's something that we have always engaged in. There is there are always efforts underway to try to begin peace talks. At this point, we also completed a peace deal with one of the insurgent groups, which increased optimism amongst other insurgent groups who also want to take advantage of the model that was presented to the Hizb-e-Islami group to see if they can also negotiate a settlement. So we're working on that process, and hopefully more and more groups will join that process.
Mm-hmm. So the sticking points to restarting formal talks are that more and more insurgent groups are on board with it?
Well, there had been no precedence in Afghanistan on any kind of negotiation. So our peace deal with Hizb-e-Islami presented the first model of what it could look like.
What is the Taliban's future in your country, in your country's government, possibly?
Well, the Afghan people want an end to this war, and we're doing everything as a government represented by representing the people to make sure that the Afghan people's desire is met. We've got to protect the Afghan public from attacks, indiscriminate attacks, and make sure that the Afghan sovereignty is maintained, but at the same time move towards a position where we can negotiate with those who perhaps have political grievances. Now, in Afghanistan, it's not just the Taliban. Amongst those groups, there are criminals, and there are also international terrorists who we cannot negotiate with. And they don't want anything from the Afghan government or the Afghan people. Their goals are completely different. But those who do have political grievances and could be integrated into the system, we're happy to do that and are open to negotiation.
Is ISIS, the Islamic State, present in Afghanistan?
There is a presence of what we call Daesh in Afghanistan, yes. And we have been clearing those operations with the support of our international partners, more specifically the United States. We had clearing operations in the areas where they are trying to form a presence, and it's an ongoing process.
Mm-hmm. As I mentioned at the outset, our president. Gave us word months ago that the U.S. will maintain over 8,000 troops in Afghanistan into 2017. How are they working with Afghan troops? What is their role, and how do you see them meshing with the government troops?
So, Ben, I want to first thank the American people for their continued support to Afghanistan, and then highlight that today, we are fighting the same enemy that we began fighting against together to eliminate terrorism, not just from Afghanistan, but from the region and the world. And today we're doing it with very minimum support from the international community. Just 2 years ago, we had over 140,000 foreign troops, a vast majority of them were American troops that were fighting on behalf of the entire world. Today, it's the Afghan security forces that are taking the lead, that are conducting the operations and protecting the Afghan soil and people from terrorism, with support from the Resolute Support Mission, which includes U.S. troops, and they provide critical advice and assist us in our fight in operations against the insurgents and terrorists. We have been able to do that successfully with, like I said, with little support, and that support includes close air support in many ways, as we are still working on building our air force.
Mm-hmm. So, recently, a group of former U.S. officials and experts issued a proposal for what they called an enduring partnership with Afghanistan, calling your nation a key front in a generational conflict against violent extremists across the greater Middle East. The group that I spoke of includes Generals McChrystal, Stanley McChrystal, and David Petraeus, both former commanders of U.S. forces in Afghanistan. What do you see going forward as the ideal Afghan-American partnership?
Well, we're looking at this as a problem that we're all working together to fix. Now, to do that, some long-term planning is required, and I think what the generals and the former representative, I think the letter you're referring to was also signed by former representatives and diplomats to Afghanistan, so ambassadors, mm-hmm. U.S. ambassadors to Afghanistan, and their recommendation was, if we're to do this, instead of short-term planning of every year, we must start to begin a long-term planning process, which would, in the end, save costs because we can plan ahead and also put us in a better advantageous position so we can move from defensive to an offensive position to bring peace and work our way towards a stable and self-reliant Afghanistan. The Afghan government it welcomed the announcement at Warsaw by NATO that they will continue to support the Afghan security forces for the next 4 years, and then most recently at Brussels on civilian aid to the Afghan to Afghanistan for another 4 years. We are hoping that we can start to plan more long-term support to Afghanistan so that it can be easier for us to plan ahead, and also for all our partners who are in this with us together.
Your country's national unity government has been in power for over 2 years. I wonder if you could tell us about what you see as some of the progress that has been made over the 2 years.
Ben, there has been tremendous amount of progress the Afghan government has made, the country as a whole, where we today have about 9 million children in school alone, right? That includes 40% girls. We have 135 universities today, both public and private. There are hospitals. Every community has access to health care and education. We just launched our Citizens Charter program, which creates this social bond between the people and the government in providing basic services to all of our population, both rural and urban. And during this process, infrastructure built. Last year, we inaugurated one of our first dams for more than 40 years since the war began. We hadn't had a big infrastructure project that was launched, which would irrigate about 80,000 hectares of land, providing opportunities for agriculture, opportunities for creating new jobs, and, of course, more economic prosperity in the country, but also bringing in electricity to the most to the areas that it will in the nearby. In terms of institutions, Afghanistan today has both democratic institutions in place and civil services. It's who are able to provide to the Afghan public, and that is something that we don't hear a lot about. We understand that most of the focus in the news today is the war, and that is natural. That's what makes the headlines, and that's what people want to hear. But thanks to the American people, we have made tremendous amount of progress at the same time. Today we have a very active democracy where we have very deep political and policy discussions about the future of Afghanistan. Most of these discussions are perhaps not new to your American audiences, but are new to Afghanistan, where we're talking about how do we do election reform. So what would be the best way to draw boundaries to so that we can have better constituencies and for our members of parliament and have a better voice in for the people.
If you've just joined us, my guest this half hour is the current ambassador to the United States from Afghanistan, Hamdullah Mohib. And he is visiting Des Moines this week as a guest of the Greater Des Moines Committee on Foreign Relations. You are visiting Iowa days before a general election, and it will be decided our choice of president for the next 4 years. How do you see that choice shaping Afghanistan's future, Ambassador?
Well, the United States is Afghanistan's fundamental partner, both in economic prosperity and regional stability. So it's important for us, and we're watching the U.S. election very closely, as many other countries are doing so. But we have an added advantage, and that is the Afghanistan and the United States have a strategic, what we call the strategic partnership agreement. We also have a bilateral security agreement, and those are the agreements that define our cooperation. So there is relative stability, even though I'm sure there will be some changes with the new government, but a lot of what will be taken forward will be within the context of those agreements that we have already signed.
Stability, regardless of who is in the White House, Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump?
Well, we hope that the United States has an established system and established democracy. We're new, and hopefully we'll be able to continue as planned, and we will take the discussion forward on how we can better position ourselves to be better partners for stability.
Mm-hmm. Can you foresee a time when Afghanistan and U.S. troops are completely out, when Afghanistan is a peaceful, self-reliant anchor of stability in the Southeast Asia region? And if so, when?
Well, Afghanistan presented its road to self-reliance strategy in London last year at the start of the National Unity Government. That was the roadmap that the Afghan government plans, and we estimated a 10-year process where we're working on economic stability. We're also launching ends that process and creating jobs and opportunities for our people, but also diversifying our economic portfolio so that we can build on our assets. This includes the agriculture field, where we're some of the what I mentioned earlier about launching these new dams and creating new agricultural facilities is to improve our food security in Afghanistan so that we're self-reliant in terms of food and we can start exporting fruit and other agricultural produce. But we're also looking at reforming our government, and we have done so. In the past 2 years, we have managed to increase our revenue by 22% by reforming our income-generating processes. That includes customs and our taxpayers' offices. And we're also working on making it better and easier for people to do business in Afghanistan. So we have, in the past year, joined the World Trade Organization. And as part of that process, we passed 21 laws and procedures. Mm. And we're working on passing the rest to make it easy for people to do business in Afghanistan. We also have Afghanistan is very rich in terms of mining opportunities there. And we're working on putting in the legal framework for us to be able to benefit from what we have in terms of resources.
Ambassador, your country is very young. Its population very young. 75%, I'm seeing, of the population in Afghanistan is younger than 35, and I believe that includes you. You are not even 35 as ambassador, correct?
That's correct. Yes, we're a young demographic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What is your hope for the next generation? How does that shape the future when so much of the population is so young?
Well, it presents a great opportunity. The Afghan population, unfortunately, went through a lot of miseries. We have seen at least four revolutions that in our lifetime, which we've seen up close and have experienced all the ups and downs from communism to the rule of the Mujahideen and civil war and the rule and the extremist rule of the Taliban and now a democratic transition that we have recently had. So we have seen what our country was and how it has changed over the years, but also learned from our own mistakes and the and how we can fix it. The Afghan population today, the vast majority of us are working extremely hard and are dedicated to ensure we return stability to our country. And we do that through different means. The Afghan public and this generation that you mentioned is technologically savvy, culturally sophisticated, educated, and very global, globalized. In terms of its thinking and its information about where we stand in the world, so it is a great opportunity. But a demographic that young can also be a threat. So we want to make sure that these young people have opportunities, have jobs, and can contribute to the country in a positive manner.
With the few minutes we have remaining, Ambassador Mohib, I wanted to have you talk a little bit about your background in reading about it. I find it fascinating. You were born in the early 80s, the youngest of, is it 11 children in a small mountain village north of Jalalabad?
Absolutely. I think you will find that in common with many American families, too. I see a lot of our friends in the U.S., I see you also have big families, and that's something we have in common. Americans and Afghans are people of family people, and we're people of faith. We work very hard, and we pride in our culture and our independence.
Mm-hmm. What do you make of the, also back to the election year, discussion here. We've had some people who will bring out anti-Muslim sentiments here in the United States. Of course, Afghanistan is a Muslim country.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've got to work together at a time instead of being divided. We have all got to work to build a better world for all of us. We have seen that instability in one part of the world affects us all directly. And prosperity in the same manner and stability also brings us all advantages. And we've seen that up in practice in not very recent past. So from where we see it, a country that has been fraught with lots of problems in the past 40 years, we think instead of using these what divides us to focus on what unites us together.
Mm-hmm. You are ambassador to the U.S. from Afghanistan now, but I understand as a young boy you lived in a refugee camp?
I did, yes. I was a refugee and was for a big part. I lived under the civil war and, like I said, under the Taliban. So we have seen a lots of different changes.
Mm-hmm. You went on to get a degree in computer systems engineering.
I did. Yeah.
In the UK.
Yeah. And one of the first things when I went to the UK and I was sitting in a class where I was at a community college, and the first thing the teacher said that I still remember is people from refugee backgrounds and very difficult backgrounds come and end up getting university degrees. And that moment, I thought, well, probably the very lucky ones. But I ended up being one of those lucky ones. With hard work, one can achieve. And I think I've learned that through my life, that one can, if you work hard and set your mind at it, you can achieve almost the impossible.
All right. Afghanistan's ambassador to the United States in Des Moines this week, Abdullah Mohib. Thank you very much for coming into our studio.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure talking with you.
And that does it for this edition of River to River. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.